Yeah.
Well, I hope the presentation lives up to the title.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do too. All right, let's go ahead and get started. I know it's pretty quick after that, the plenary session. So this is a talk that I'm giving kind of as a follow-up to some papers that I presented with colleagues at the 2018 Weedy Interactive Lecture Series of the Center for Assessment. It's a great conference that's put on by the Center for Assessment every year. And so all of these kind of go together. You've got this commercialization, proliferation, and incoherence of assessment. You've got actually being specific about our uses and purposes and matching that to the assessments that we use. And then this other one, it's a tricky balance. It's you've got challenges and opportunities to balance systems of assessment. And really what this was talking about was, this statement. So from the National Research Council, Knowing What Students Know, lovingly referred to as KWSK, right? That's an acronym that I was supposed to know, but I didn't. This was published before No Child Left Behind, and it was advocating for balanced assessment systems. So in a balanced assessment system, assessments at all levels from classroom to state will work together in a system that is comprehensive, coherent, and continuous. In such a system, assessments would provide a variety of evidence to support educational decision making, and assessments at all levels would be linked back to the same underlying model of student learning and would provide indications of student growth over time. So, if that seems familiar, it's because Jim Pellegrino was the lead author on this report. And so the question is, do we have any examples of this kind of assessment system that's been sustainable over time in a given district or in a given state or maybe even in a given school? And I don't know of any. I know of attempts to get there. I know of getting partially there, but having something where everything works together, we just don't, unless I'm totally missing something, we don't have any examples of that. So, again, comprehensive, coherent, and continuous. Comprehensive. You are going to give a full picture of who that student is in terms of how they're doing across all areas. Achievement in every subject, social-emotional learning, all of these things that we would like to know about students to really help us get the evidence we need to support really sound educational decision-making. Right? So kind of unpacking this statement. And then maybe the most important here is assessments at all levels would be linked back to the same underlying model of student learning and would provide indications of student growth over time. Right? So this is a tall order. So I actually think that unless we have a seismic shift in K-12 education, the only context in which we can develop this kind of sustainable system is at the local level. States can't do it. States have been trying for a long time to do this now. The most ambitious of the efforts were the assessment consortia. And I can say that there are some places in the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium where we are seeing some movement made at the state level, but still, it's because they're supporting these things at the local district. They're not mandating it. They are not coming in and saying, hey, we are going to help you. You're being voluntold, right? So it's about helping districts and understanding that those are resources, that they're technical support, they're technical assistance. And it was a difficult lesson that I had to learn as a state assessment director, that if I ever wanted to really make that kind of difference with our state assessments, I had to support local professional learning, and it had to be no strings attached. It had to be in a way that was seen as a benefit and not as some way that I could get additional data, find additional information on the schools. You can't do that. So, in addition, focusing on the district level eliminates some key power dynamics. And it's one of the things that I've really focused on for the last several years, is as one of the reasons that we have such a hard time doing this. Right? We have people at different levels, different degrees of authority, and each of those different levels needs something different to come out of the assessment system. And it means negotiating shared power. And that can be really hard. In particular, you know, the way that that accountability, school accountability, set up, in particular, the educator evaluation is set up. At the state level, there is concern that it could be more easily turned toward nefarious purposes. Even if there's no intent to do that on the part of the state, but there is reasonable and justifiable fear. So I think that focusing on the district level eliminates some of those power dynamics, which I think is a good thing. And it also makes it clear to states in ways that Andy's trying to do that this really is technical assistance. This isn't coming in and being voluntold that you're going to do X, Y, or Z. So I think it leaves us to local staff who already have those relationships to develop that kind of power sharing in the local dynamics of the system. So, let me check one thing. Sorry. Okay. So let's go ahead. Proliferation. Why has proliferation become such an issue with assessment? One of the reasons that proliferation has become such an issue with assessment is that, particularly with the higher stakes accountability, people are desperate to get information that will help them do their job. And it's really easy, if I am doing my job, to say I'm going to implement X assessment. And someone else to say, I'm going to implement Y assessment. That doesn't really work. So you end up getting a lot of assessments that are really selected for niche purposes. And you also have something that I've seen in a lot of districts as well, is there are a lot of assessments that are given just because the law has been given. And we can't really remember why they're given anymore, but we always do when we maybe look at the data. So we see that it's something that is common. And commercialization is important because it's a plug and play. You get a lot of commercialization because you can buy the product, it's already there, you just put it in place, you use the results as whoever wanted to put it into place, you use the results as you intend, and then when you leave, maybe it keeps getting used the same way, but maybe it doesn't, and maybe or maybe not, it goes away. So, an incoherence. Part of why do we have incoherent assessments? Why do the state assessments potentially tell us something different than we got on our district common assessments? And why do the district common assessments potentially tell me something different than I had on my end of unit tests? And why are they telling me something different than what I had in my daily homework, right? You've got a lot of these different things going on. And So we have a lot of pressures, and I think most of it comes down to, one, fractured vocabulary around assessment. We all say, let's say, for example, interim assessment. What is an interim assessment? There are 1,000 definitions of interim assessment. It's basically anything that isn't kind of the final judgment, and it's not classroom formative, right? Everything else is interim. That's a lot, right? So, fractured vocabulary, different needs for different people, assumptions by those who are at a higher level in the hierarchy that if they get what they need, the people that work for them are also getting what they need. And just power imbalances. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to present is just one of many different ways that a local balanced assessment system could be implemented. And I will say that this is the design that was come up with by one of the districts here in Michigan by going through a principled process to address those power imbalances, to address the different needs of different people, to have those negotiations around, okay, maybe it makes my job harder at a higher level to have the things that you need more of them because you all have different job responsibilities, but I can work around that because I need my employees to really have what they need so that I can succeed. It's going to show up if I do that, right? So, and again, it's just one of many different ways, but it is a design that was come up with by one of our districts. So the idea here is, you know, going back to this quote at the very beginning, a coherent learning theory across everything that we're doing. And this is way too often neglected in the way that we address an assessment system. So we have at least a good start on this now because the Common Core and the NGSS really do have an underlying learning theory attached to them. It may not be terribly well developed, but it does have an underlying modern learning theory. It's not what we have seen as behind many large-scale commercial and state assessments. So states, at least there's an implicit learning theory, and it's implicitly modern, and the standards were developed based on that, and the annual state assessments, in theory, are developed to be based on that same set of standards and the same learning theory. And again, in a large-scale assessment, it can be difficult to do that because we can only do so much in an on-demand assessment. So what's the next step? The district, right? The district now takes control. And if we really don't trust what is coming out of our learning the learning theory, the standards, and the annual state assessment, I'm okay if you cut that left part off, these two, the ones that are just board. Like, okay, sometimes you really can't make it work with whatever assessment you have. But again, as I say, we at least have some hope because that was underlying those assessment systems. So the district uses its curriculum to plan and develop. Oh, I have to go back and just say, yes, of course, the learning theory and the standards should be taken into consideration in curriculum. And one of the interesting things that I saw when I was serving on some technical advisory committees, particularly for consortia, was discussion of actual learning theory in an assessment tack. It was like, wow, advisory committees, this is like mind-blowing. We're actually talking about learning theory in assessment tech. And so this is what we want to do. And the idea is if the state's annual summative assessment is of high enough quality, you can actually use that in addition. You know, this should never be the primary driver for a curriculum, of course. But if it's really high quality, there may be some things in there that could be useful. And then the district uses its curriculum to plan and develop its final exams and final projects. Right? And again, if the state's annual state assessments are of high quality, that can be used to feed in. Because it is hard to write good assessments. It's really hard to write good tests. But always having to keep in mind that there are always going to be things at the local level that can't be put on a state assessment. And, you know, we don't want to do that kind of narrowing, of course. So what this district decided to do was to use the state assessments to inform, but not drive, the district development summative and of course, final exams. And then we have to move from the administrative level to the teacher level. All right, so here we have the district developed final exams and projects feeding into three district developed, but teacher timed, mid-semester exams and projects. And note here that, again, we are now addressing this issue of different levels in the hierarchy, who has control, where is that locus of control? Here, and here, and here, but it's also here if we are working with our educators to identify the curriculum and develop final exams and projects in the quality way. So it is about sharing, power across those political boundaries. So those weekly, so teachers then use that those three mid-semester exams and projects, and they're going to develop their weekly quizzes, their graded homework, kind of those end of small unit kinds of things that are being done. And the district said, we're going to get completely away from this. We are not going to try to touch anything below this level in terms of assessments, which was a change for the district. And then, of course, you have your major unit planning that comes from the curriculum that can feed into those mid-semester exams and projects. And again, this is what that's sharing about here is. Now, the district is developing these, but teachers are free to adapt and adopt as they see fit to meet the needs of their students. So there's, you know, this is, the intent of this was not to kind of audit what's happening, but to reduce some of the workload so that people can have a more time to really think about the rest of the system. So here the teachers, again, use the district developed major unit plans to do their own weekly unit plans, or, you know, however often that happens. And then those also feed back, and you've got that feedback loop between the weekly unit plans and weekly quizzes and graded homework. And that then also feeds into daily lesson plans. And note, again, the learning theory attached to everything. And some daily instruction, of course, coming from those daily lesson plans and from the learning theory. Then we have daily formative assessment. And so what strikes you about this chart? It's like first impressions. Yes?
I think it's pretty logical. I did have two quick questions.
Sure.
When you say final exam, you mean at the end of the semester?
Yeah.
Not end of the year. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, I'm a high school science teacher.
Yeah.
So I'm on the orange side of this stuff. And
yes,
this sort of is how we do things in my district. But my question is, how in-depth are the major unit plans and the curriculum that the district is developing? Is that just a list of standards to cover and when to cover them, or is it a little more in-depth than that?
The intent with this district is to make it much more in-depth. And the purpose, again, it's kind of taking what I talked about and what I learned as a state assessment director. If I'm really going to make a difference, I have to provide resources.
Right.
The only place where I can have any kind of accountability role is on the state annual summative assessment. Everything else has to be technical assistance and has to be seen that way. There are no strings attached to that, right? So they were trying to kind of do that as well. And it was an interesting set of conversations about how you actually get there. Because one of the things... Oh, so you had one question. Did you have another question?
No, just how in-depth were the unit plans?
Yeah, they were pretty in depth, but again, it was adapt or adopt. So, yes. And anything else that strikes me?
Well,
March?
I guess I am struck that there really is apparently some coherence. There is a line out of learning theory that connects everything to everything else. Nothing's hanging out there, not related. It strikes me as making more sense as a way to pull off a coherent program than I've often seen.
So, I was impressed with what this district did, and I agree with that. And another thing that struck me as we were going through this is how much of this is Orange, how much of this is in the control of the teacher, and that was a major shift in the thinking of the district that did this work. To really think about, if we want to improve what's happening for our kids, we have to hand this over to our teachers. And we have to provide them resources so it's possible for them to do this kind of thing. Because this is intense. And now, the last little piece here about, you know, major players in the system is we have to put the student directly into the system. And often with our assessment system, we kind of forget the student. So what they're doing is they're talking about, you know, daily formative assessment, minute-to-minute understanding of where students are, modifying instruction in a way that's planned, if, you know, particularly if we know about formative assessment, in a way that is actually planned in advance in that lesson plan to say, okay, I'm going to take a look at what's happening here, and if I see X, I'm going to have to rethink, and then you do, here are my plans to go in one direction or another. And kind of then also feeding back in to the next lesson, the next day's lesson plan. So you got, if you look at that one, that's a lot of loops, right? You got a lot of looping going on. And so that is something that also struck me about this, was how much we had that looping happen. And one of the things that is often forgotten is that if you want this to actually work, you have to have some good, you have to have some pre-service and in-service professional learning. Because the work that we're talking about here, this isn't easy. And maintaining a coherent assessment system can be very difficult. And one of the things that this district did as kind of the last activity was to begin thinking about the pitfalls that they are going to run into when they try to implement this, and to make a strategic plan about how they're going to go about doing this, and documenting the procedure they went through, so that when someone wants to add a new assessment, we can pull this out and say, how does this fit in here? This is our learning, and if we decide we want to change it, let's change it, but in a coherent way. And to be able to say, if we put something in place, what comes out? Right. So we've done this in four districts around the state, and in general, we went from something, you know, on the order of 20 to 25 different uses and purposes for assessment down to 13, 14, or 15. And that means a lot more time for instruction. And it's not necessarily the state assessment. It's everything else that sits in here. It's everything else that sits in here that takes up way more time than the state assessment, but the state assessment gets the bad rap. And at the same time, I am seeing states trying to be much more efficient in their gathering of data so they can also reduce it. Right? So that's kind of the plan. So, now, I go back to something that was said by a man I admire, Ted Kolodarchy. He says, you know, a collection of tests no more resembles a system than a pile of bricks constitutes a house. And so this was an interesting exercise, and what I like to do is I like to ask, does the system that I exist within resemble this? And are there places where we do have that kind of incoherence, where we could have some efficiencies? And what the districts actually did is they looked at the match between types of assessment, who controls the content, who controls the timing of the assessment, how it's going to be used, to whether it's a formative assessment practice, whether it's interim assessment, whether it's under the control entirely of the teacher, whether or not it's kind of shared, as you see here. And then starting to think about, okay, let's think about our highest priority purposes. We already know we have, we decided we want maybe 15. We're going to cut out those ones that, I'm not sure why we're doing this one. And we're going to focus on our highest priority purposes. And when we start with our highest priority purposes, we find the assessments with the best match to our highest priority purposes. And then if we have slightly worse match for some of our lower priority purposes, that's okay. We can still get at it. But we don't want to overwhelm our highest priority purposes with a whole bunch of additional purposes that aren't quite as high. So I can tell you, what I can tell you is that it's kind of been a theme of this conference. This is daunting. this is a lot of work to transform what is an existing district assessment system into something that is coherent, that supports the educators, because the educators are the heart and their interaction with the student is the very heart of the system. How can we begin the transition? So three of the four districts, I'm not quite sure where the fourth district is, they have worked really hard to sell the group that we brought together, maybe 20 people, between 15 and 20 people from each district, have worked really hard to sell to their district leadership, this is where we want to go, this is our vision. We know it's going to take a long time to get here, but the first step is working on the orange and red. That's the first step. We have to have the assessment literacy before we can create really good quizzes and grade homework. We have to have assistance in creating those small unit plans. We have to have assistance in actual conversations about what kind of learning theory we're basing our instruction on, we're basing our assessments on, right? So that's what they decided to do is they've spent an awful lot of time and effort. They rearranged a lot of budget priorities to make this a real key part of their professional learning plan. And right, it's not perfection, but it's the start, right? And to be clear, I'm trained as a psychometrician. I have done some instruction, but it's not like almost everyone here. I'm almost a different breed, right? So I know where I stop. I know the research around balanced assessment systems. I know the research around high quality classroom assessment. I know the research around a lot of these things, but I don't do it. And so my involvement stopped here. They can come back to me, they can talk with me, we can ask and answer questions. But my involvement stopped after helping some ISD facilitators from Oakland Schools and Wayne Risa to work with the districts to prioritize the new system, to identify which ones we're going to do, what kind of purpose are we going to build with, what kind of assessment, what are the characteristics that it needs to have. And so I know that I stopped there. I know I can't go in and I can't help them actually develop these local assessment systems. I can help them plan. I can help them create the vision. But and the nice thing was that's where we handed things off to the Michigan Assessment Consortium and to the ISD folks. I have to respect when I'm out of my depth and implementing this, I'm out of my depth. Pretty good. So that's kind of where we went. So again, let's talk about barriers to development and maintenance, which is one of the last things we asked our districts to do, was to really think carefully about this and think about how they're going to prepare for these barriers. So, power dynamics, right? In my experience, that's kind of the number one. If you can't resolve power dynamics, you're not going to get there. So we have to start with the power sharing. And, you know, the state shares power with districts, of course. So if the state is interested in doing this kind of work, you know, it's about providing that technical assistance as a voluntarily received service without any strings attached. Right? It's potentially providing the resources to have professional learning on modern learning theory, refreshers, whatever. Technical assistance on evaluating commercial materials and developing custom curriculum materials. Formative assessment coaching. The state of Michigan has done a lot of this, and it's been pretty successful. And technical assistance on developing aligned midterm and final exams and projects. And then a high-quality platform where the interim components, the formative resources and tools, and the summative, you know, and connectors to those instructional materials are provided as a no strings attached service. And that was part of the theory of action behind Smarter Balance. You know, the Library of Digital Resources was supposed to serve in that role, and supposed to help people. I did create high quality assessments to meet what they need at a given time, and it's partly there with Smarter Balance. It's not quite there, but a state could provide that kind of service. And there are states that are trying to, California and Nevada in particular, are really working on this part of it. Then we again have administrator sharing power with teachers. You have local leaders negotiating with teacher representatives, and this has been a part of the activity that took place after we worked with these four districts. So, you know, getting buy-in on the curriculum, final exams, final projects, you know, all this stuff that the district is providing as a service or as a mandate. And again, teachers sharing power with administrators. Teachers voluntarily coordinating their weekly unit planning and district created major unit plans with because their district creative materials are of high quality and reduces teacher workload. You know, from my experience, the only way we can get from anything from the top down is if it is of high quality, it's not viewed as a threat, and it reduces workload. So again, teachers would voluntarily coordinate weekly quizzes and grades on homework with district-created mid-semester exams and projects, again, for the same reason. And then, now I went the wrong way. And then this is, you know, teacher sharing power with students. If I could talk about a hallmark of formative assessment, that's a hallmark of formative assessment. It's about, you know, sharing the learning targets in student-friendly language so that they know exactly where they're going to go, and they can tell how they would be able to judge whether they've gotten there. Taking feedback from students to evaluate and improve their own practice, offering multiple opportunities for targeted scaffolding to students before any summative evaluation. That is, anything that contributes to a final grade. It changes the nature of the teacher-student interaction if the student knows it's going to be part of a final grade. And so, right, and again, we have a collection of assessments that's not entail a system any more than a pile of parts constitutes a house. So I keep coming back to this one. If we actually want to get where the National Research Council and Jim Pellegrino were really talking about 19 years ago, actually 20 years ago when they first wrote it, we have to keep coming back to this idea of, are we developing something that looks more like a house than a pile of bricks in our assessment system? So, talking about this one ends at 2:30. Okay. So I do have to leave some time for Q&A and conversation. So I want to stop there and just ask, I just want to have a conversation about whether it is possible for this to be done. Like, is this actually something that is possible at a local level? All right, it doesn't have to look like this. In fact, it could have completely different structure. But can we have that kind of collaboration in a way that, if it's good for me, it's good for you? Right. Or if it's good for you, it's good for me. Yeah, right.
Joseph, it seems
to
me that this could be a really effective system built for something else. And some new law is going to come walking down from above and throw the whole thing into chaos. And it reminds me, years ago I heard someone draw this analogy, not about building a house, that a pork farmer doesn't assume that it's going to make the pig heavier by weighing more. And every time they don't know what to do with our schools, they mandate a new test. Gotta weigh it again, gotta weigh it again. We're bound to make something happen. Well, you're not bound to make something happen, but we get so many things coming from on high that throws a local district out of control.
Yeah, and that has been a real worry with the four districts that did this work.
Yes.
Is two of them now have a new superintendent since it was done. There's some concern about whether or not this will continue, but in an attempt to help avoid that kind of thing, they have documented what they did, why they made the choices.
And solid in place.
Right. And if you think about it, there's, I've talked a lot about a theory of action in this conference. Other people, I think, have been in my presentations. I am just more and more struck in education policy that we put policies in place without any kind of theory of change, without any kind of theory of action. And this is a theory of action. This district put together a theory of action of how they're going to get from where they are now to where they want to be, with the students much more engaged, student outcomes being much better, and just a lot more collaboration across the district. Right? So that's actually a theory of action, which is kind of cool. We didn't even realize we were doing that. I didn't realize we were doing that when I was helping people work through this, but came out and said, well, that's actually a theory of action of how we're going to make a change in the district. So, I just want to ask, what part of this system is going to be the most difficult to put in place and maintain?
Charter school in Detroit, and we kind of do things this way. You know, we're trying to move that way. I think the two challenges I see is that because we're small, essentially a small school district, the curriculum falls on the teachers to produce. So there's, as a teacher, no one's giving me a curriculum. I've got a pacing guide that I'll get, but I've got to come up with the curriculum and the unit plans. So my workload as a teacher in a small district, if you will, is much bigger to try to fill that void. The other challenge I see is, as teachers, when we get these mid-semester exams and we have benchmark exams and stuff, we have a lot of distrust in how they're going to be used to evaluate us.
Yeah.
So that voluntary piece is not there. I mean, for us, it's mandated, it's not voluntary, and the distrust is high, which leads to a lot of pushback in terms of even using anything in terms of, like, looking at the assessment feedback and using any of it, because you're just distrustful as a teacher. Well, some teachers are distrustful. So those pieces are hard for us.
And so it's power dynamics.
It does come to power dynamics.
And workload.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of sense. Particularly around student growth and educator evaluation. I won't editorialize on that one.
Do the districts that went through this, are they using things outside of this system for teacher eval? Do they have like an NWA or other
That is a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if it's outside this. You know, and if it is outside, it's it may be, you know, this area.
Okay.
Right. Not the really close
right.
areas. And actually, one of the... Okay, go ahead.
So this makes sense in a secondary mm-hmm. world, but in an elementary world where we're expected to give screeners and... How does that fit into this?
Okay, that's a good question. And I do have to say that this was the easiest part to do, was kind of the high school part. And we did try, when we worked with these districts, to kind of differentiate across levels. We didn't have a lot of success. I think you would actually have to carry out the activity separately in those three, and then see how you can make those things all work together. So we were working primarily with people whose mindset was more on the high school side. But I don't think it would be too difficult to be able to put these, you know, kind of the screeners somewhere in this area, you know, in that area of the diagram. You know, I think we would just have to be intentional about doing that same kind of activity with more of a focus on the elementary school. Because, you know, in general, this does work with middle schools and with high schools. It doesn't work so much as it's currently constructed with the elementary schools. And as I said, we actually tried to look at different priorities for different levels in the school system, and it just didn't work very well. So...
Like, I see multiple layers of weekly uniforms, multiple layers of each one of these, and a lot on the teacher when that time is, you know, finite resource.
Right. Yeah, I'd like to hear. I mean, I think you could set this up a lot of different ways, but you talked about a seismic shift we need to make, and that has to happen first, and then you can rearrange these boxes. But to have a teacher or to have a system inside a school to be able to do these kind of things, school has to look really different.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how you make that kind of...
So that actually is... I can tell you what... I'm going to sit down for just a second. One of the school districts that we work with... Sorry, bad knees, you know.
Are the school districts a secret?
So the four districts that have done this work are, Wayne Westland, Dearborn, Bloomfield Hills, and Novi.
What was the last one?
Novi. And each of them are in different places in trying to implement this, and I think there may be one where it was looked at as, this is so different from what we're doing, we're going to just take the first step of focusing more on formative assessment. Those are the four districts that have done it. What was it? I was going to say something else, but I forgot. So, yes.
And I think the other important piece is that, along with the pressures that they talk about and the distrust, is our accountability system is based on tests that are almost necessarily not going to show growth or going to show minimal growth with these kinds of activities, just the way they're created. So I think that's an additional pressure. And until we remove all that accountability and all that pressure, and using these kind of tests, just don't measure that kind of stuff well and say, no, that's not the way we do it, then I don't think these are going to show you that.
As I said, you know, as a former state assessment director, it pains me to say this, but I'm okay to cut this part out.
Right.
because of that conflicting use and the conflicting pressures that come around that. And if you were in the presentation that Brian Lloyd and I gave just before lunch, we talked about using growth, and, you know, I've done a lot of my work around growth measures on state assessments. And I am more along the lines of, I'm going to set this up the way I need to get what done what I need done. And I would really rather look at how well, if I were a district administrator, I would like to take the risk and say, you know, I don't know what hammers they have if I don't do exactly what they said. So I'm going to turn it just a little bit. I'm going to look at how well we're actually implementing formative assessment in our classrooms. Right? I'm going to actually implement potentially well-done SLOs. Or SLOs can be done terribly. But I would really negotiate implementing very well-done SLOs along with the formative assessment coaching. And I would want to be able to just say, okay, let's think about artifacts that could show me that the practice of formative assessment is getting better over time. So it's a risk. Of course, I've talked to a lawyer to make sure I'm not putting this at an unacceptable risk. But I am really frustrated as a former state assessment director around how much this gets in the way of that. I'm really frustrated by that. And I know it does, and there are only a couple of places where I'm actually seeing it not get in the way of that. Particularly in English language arts and mathematics in California and in Nevada. But it's really hard to do. You have to have a lot of political will.
Could you share a little bit about that sentence you just...
Yeah, so with Smarter Balance, there is the... So the way it was, the historical development of Smarter Balance was the primary deliverable that we had to provide to the federal government was an annual state assessment in English, Language Arts, and Mathematics. But we were also given funding to develop a library of digital resources for formative assessment tools and resources, as well as links to curriculum materials or specific links to, you know, content that addresses this very small collection of content standards. And there's been a lot of work on that. It hasn't been as well received as we thought it would be, and I'm no longer with the consortium, but the thing that really made a difference is that, so after developing the summative assessment, a mini summative assessment was developed. You could take an assessment multiple times during the same year, but frankly, that there's no use in that. What am I going to do with the information? And that was the experience of the educators who said, in fact, it was the educators who demanded that first. Right? Educators demanded that first. I think mostly administrators demanded that first. But as soon as it came out, they said, well, what am I going to do with that? So they asked for interim block assessments. And interim block assessments, you know, cover maybe, I don't know, a tenth of the content standards on the Smarter Balanced Assessment. So kind of small, but still, it's really hard to go back and do something different if it's been, you know, 3 weeks or a month since you last had a data point. And so now what Smarter Balanced has been doing is they have been developing focused interim block assessments. And those are really small. Two or three content standards, no more. And they're starting with the ones that are particularly known to be pain points in education, for example, in mathematics, reasoning around, why can't I remember the name? It's proportions, proportional reasoning. Right. That's been identified in the literature as something that's difficult, and when you can get subscores off of standardized tests, that's where kids do the worst. And there's a lot of qualitative research out there showing this is one of the things that teachers struggle with, so kind of really closely focusing on that. So we've actually seen some movement in that direction, and the focused interim block assessments were released at the very end of last year. But the number of focused interim assessment block, the focused interim block assessments that have been given in California and Nevada, it's surprisingly helpful. People find it actually really useful for what they're doing.
Just because the breadth of how amorphous these standards are, you just worked on this one specific one, but if you look at the actual fourth grade standards, there's, what, 44,000 of them, and underneath those, there's another 80,000. So, yeah, we were able to do one really well, and it got some useful information, but as a system,
So at the end of last year, I think one or two really good ones were developed, and we're now the consortium is up to something like
I exaggerated what I
said. No, but it's they've actually really no, it is it's true, it's fine, but so it is. It's the first time I have actually seen a large scale assessment organization try to realize its theory of action. I've never seen that before, and. Again, it was difficult to come to the same realization that was difficult for me to come to. I can't build this top down. It just can't happen top down. These have to be resources, and so what's really good about the way it's been used, and of course there are lots of holes. It doesn't cover everything, and nor would you want it to. You want to leave some room. You want, and again, it's optional. But it now has a lot of people, educators at the classroom level, at the building level, at the district level, and at the state level, having conversations around student work, having conversations around student data. So I'm very, very cautiously optimistic that something like this can coexist with an annual state assessment used for accountability purposes, but I'm pretty cautious about that as well. So there's it.
No, like we look at things very differently. You look for the useful things, what can work, and I say, Jesus, this isn't going to work. So those kind of quotes are.
Yeah, incurable optimist, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good thing.
So let's go ahead and let's see how much.
Yeah,
20 minutes. So again, we talked about this previously. Why do I think there's this? I really do think, I don't think we can emphasize enough that it's about power imbalance. It's combined with accountability. I don't think we can create anything systematic, coherent, and balanced unless we are explicit in dealing with power imbalances and accountability. And those truly were some of the most difficult conversations. They were really messy, but they had to be had. If you're going to come up with a plan and work to...
And then you just had to put that last bullet, didn't you?
Well, I actually don't think that in general of education. I do think that there is some of that, but I don't think it's the general rule in education. So, you know, and the reason I say that is that, one, we have to be careful about how we talk about this with people who are in a position of power. And it's really easy to say things in a way that imply this is done with malice, or this is done, you know, it's a power trip, or it's a power grab. Right? It's really easy to say things those ways. So that's why I put that in there, because I actually don't think it's that way, and I think it would hurt the conversation if we didn't talk about it that way. So again, I do think it's this different roles, different needs, lack of understanding that different tests are good for different purposes. So it's just going to take an example. NWEA has its purposes. It is a well-run assessment. It is, you never have a problem with that, with the infrastructure. and it's used in all kinds of places, but how many ways is NWEA used?
Too many.
Way
too
many.
More than it's intended.
I'm sorry?
I was just saying, it should be used for what?
And what's that?
Growth. That's it. But we use it, sometimes we use it for determining it. Proficiency, or determining or projecting proficiency, or grade level, or
teacher proficiency.
How good the teacher is at growing students, but it really should just be used to see how much student A has grown from fall just for now.
It's also sometimes used for qualification to get into other kinds of programs.
Mm.
Yes. And who gets it in intelligence?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that was actually stated with one of the NWA representatives here at the conference in one of the other systems, and it just like all of them are. And you know, it's interesting. But so that's NWA. Now think about how many ways is homework used? Homework is an assessment. Anything we send home, anything we're gonna grade, that's an assessment. But how many different ways is homework used? First
compliance.
Sense of
punishment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are bad things. Right. But you know, it goes back to the grading practices. Clamoring yesterday. In a lot of ways, we are assigning grades as a classroom management procedure. In a lot of ways, we do that. And I don't think we do it with malice. I think we're trying to do our best job as educators.
Sure.
So any other ways that you can think of that homework is used? Okay.
As a way of students being able to practice a skill. And then but not graded. That's the thing, is kids won't do homework, especially at the secondary level. They will not do homework unless you attach a grade to it. And there are some kids who are self-motivated enough that they will do it because they know that it does help. And I know I work with an Upward Bound program, and this summer, the kids can't do homework because of the way their summer program was designed. So everything has to be done in class. But I give them assignments that they have to do over the weekend. They're not graded, but they have to show mastery of that skill when they come back the following week. And getting the kids out of the mindset that, well, why do I have to do it if it's not being graded? When they come back and they have a project that they have to do in which they have to use that skill, and they haven't done the work at home over the weekend, and they're like, now I get it.
So, at least one person that was in one of my previous presentations knows the story that's going to come. My kids attend a school system that is very much a traditional school system where everything that goes home has been graded. And there has been some recent movement away from that. And last year, in a real departure, there was some pilot work done around the NGSS work. And my son was coming home, and I saw him get like a D on a science test. I was like, what? I've never seen you get anything less than a B. Come on. What's this? And he said, well, I just didn't know the stuff. I'm like, well, why didn't you know the stuff? I don't know. You've been doing your homework? No. You haven't been doing your homework? You gotta be kidding. So I asked him why. I said, well, it's not going to be graded, so I don't have to do it. It's fine. I think she just wants us to do it, and I don't know. And it wasn't communicated with him. The thing is, it was a really good move, right? It was a really good move. It gives the student the opportunity to demonstrate or have that feedback loop with the teacher before getting some of their grade. He didn't know that. So I emailed the teacher and just brought that to attention. Oh, that's a really good idea. I'll just tell them why I'm doing this. And my son finally understood what the class was about. So it was fun. You know, and the thing is, that's progress, not perfection. Right? That's fine. One of the, you know, you think about making summative judgments as one of the uses of homework. You think about formative approaches, and may not be one day to the next, or you might be one day to 3 days later because you're going back and making sure you're going to death. But you know, it's and then you've got compliance, classroom management. So
What, and again, there was the comment that homework maybe should really have the purpose of formative feedback cycles between teacher and student. And in the U.S. education system, that's a real departure from the way it used to be, and still a lot of a departure from where it currently is. So, but I also do think that, again, I said this before, a lack of understanding that if I choose an assessment that meets my needs, that will work for those who work for me. And that's really not necessarily the case. So I'm going to go back to one of my previous presentations as well on growth for accountability purposes. Think about a superintendent or a district principal who is just overwhelmed. He has to do, or she has to do, 4 walkthroughs per year or whatever is negotiated in the contract with every teacher, particularly in high school, that can be 500 walkthroughs every year. You got a lot of stuff going on. And so they want something that they're going to be held accountable for that they can digest in one number. But that one number isn't going to work if it's a math number for my geometry teacher, where the geometry assessment only has about 20% of the item on there, 20% of its items on geometry versus algebra 1 versus algebra 2. And then, again, getting to the point of using assessments that have no relationship to the teaching responsibilities. Not because of knowledge, but because it's just overwhelmed with how much work the educator evaluation is, right? It's hard. So, again, a sense of urgency given those accountability uses. I have to find something now that is going to help me because I'm really worried about major employment decisions based on the growth of my students on an assessment. So, and then again, the fractured vocabulary in assessment. Again, we mean all kinds of things, and I don't care. I really don't care what we settle on, but we have to all know what we're talking about when we're talking to each other. And that is not easy. So, so just want to get people's reactions to this. How far away are we from that? How close are we to that around the room? Because I know that, so one of the reasons I asked this question is when I was looking at the program, at least half of the topics were either talking about formative assessment and classroom assessment, even if they didn't have it in their title. So it's been a real, I've seen that the focus on that has shifted, particularly in MSDC, over the last 10 years, way away from kind of the summative assessment. So I just wanted to ask that question. How close are we? Do you have this? How close are we? How far away is it? Who does it serve?
I'm beginning to get teacher evaluations as far away from assessment as we can for this function. Because I'm in a district that uses this.
Yeah.
And it is bigger than you could even think. Like, I would take the black marker and color all over the whole thing, right? NWEA. It's huge, and that stuff. I don't know how to fix it until that's not a part of it.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons in the session before lunch I talked about, I'm willing to risk, personally, I might be fired if I'm a district leader because I have no actual student goal scores in teacher evaluations, but I'm looking at evidence, specific evidence, that teachers are doing what's necessary to improve their teaching, to improve that feedback cycle with the students, because that actually has been shown to really improve outcomes. There's no evidence, or very, very, very small evidence, that there might be a very small effect to increase student outcomes based on using test scores and growth on those for educator bias. It's tiny. It's tiny if it does exist at all. So I would be willing to address that. But
keep
that's me.
That.
So,
could you say that a little louder so people can all hear?
And again, I go back to, and I would also make sure that I wasn't exposing the district to too much risk.
Yeah.
You have to do that.
And there's a lot of ways to do that without falling on your sword. You can just minimize the effect of the state assessment, in effect giving everybody the same score. And I think a lot of districts are doing that, so I'm not sure what district.
I feel like it has happened in our district, but the teachers don't understand. They still, even I've explained to them that one teacher in our whole district has ever been rated ineffective based on end of day district. I can say that all day long, and they don't feel that way. I've sat with a first grade teacher in tears when her number percentage goes higher than it should be. And she feels like a failure. And she feels like her boss is going to turn and look at her and perceive her as a failure as well. And that the community is going to feel like she's a failure. And it's very deep. This is such a personal thing to people. And your evaluation is such a personal thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, as long as it's there, I don't see that. And I don't mean to recommend it.
No, you're right.
Your evaluation is public, too. It's on the state website.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wish we could fix the definitions of formative assessment, because I feel right now in our school district, which I don't want to name, that there's as many definitions of formative assessment as there are flavors of sparkling water right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in fact, that is the definition that is the most important to have. Right. There is one right definition of formative.
Yes.
There is actually one right definition, and the reason I say that is that is that when formative assessment is implemented in the way that it's described in the literature, where it has large effect size, it's the only one that has been demonstrated to have that kind of effect. Right. So that's the one place I wanted to set my neck on and say, that's the one I think I have a right definition, and we have to be settled on that. Right? And it has to be, it's not a thing.
That's key to this whole system working, though, that you have outlined. Formative assessment is a critical piece so that we don't have to have as many NWAI readies and all these other things that are out there. If we could leverage formative assessment, we could change a lot of things.
And a lot of, so I've had some people. But there have been a lot of arguments about definition of formative assessment that, you know, they go beyond what was necessarily in the literature. And some people say it's not formative any time it is an evaluation. Other people have said it's not formative any time you score it. It's not formative whenever you put an S on it. and so there are good reasons to argue both. Either way, well, maybe you do want to provide a score because it helps us even understand where they are. But they know it's not a grade, right? But there are other places where, in some cases, you might make the argument that students so associate numeric scores with grading that maybe all we can do is do descriptive numerics. That's all we can do. So I understand it, but for my money, that is a place where you really have to get on the same page. No, I think.
Okay, to end early.
Okay. Ed, I appreciate your attendance, and thank you.
Thank you.